Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. Our moderator is Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for USA Today and West Wing Reports.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. The U.S. government will launch an effort to round up thousands of undocumented migrants across the United States. President Trump has backed away from using the upcoming 2020 census to ask who is an American citizen and who is not. Britain's ambassador to the United States resigns after diplomatic cables are leaked, revealing his thoughts about President Trump. And the latest from the Persian Gulf, Britain's Royal Navy accuses Iran of interfering with a British oil tanker. Well, let's start with this issue of rounding up undocumented migrants. Obviously, one of the biggest issues for President Trump, Tom. And what we understand here is that in the coming days, officials are, from reports at least, going to start rounding up these migrants. And officials in big cities with lots of immigrants, New York, Los Angeles, Houston, Miami, and so forth, they are expecting these raids. And federal officials from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, also known as ICE, are likely to deport a lot of these folks. What's going to happen here?
Well, the president had telegraphed this about a month ago in a tweet where he said that millions of illegal aliens will be deported, and it caused a lot of consternation both in the immigrant community and the civil libertarian community. He backed off on that because the government doesn't have enough officers to handle millions, but I think we may be talking about thousands here. And the president and his immigration and homeland security officials are saying, we're going after illegal aliens who have been so identified and who have gone through the court system and who have been ordered deported by federal judges. And the president's attitude is, they've had due process. They've been here a long time. They have no legal standing. They've been ordered deported, so we're going to deport them. So how many that's going to be, I don't know. It will be thousands. It'll create even more consternation in the immigrant community. But just how many remains to be seen.
Now, Linda, one thing about this is Tom said that the federal government does not have enough personnel to round up all of these folks, even just a few thousand. They apparently don't. So they're hoping that local police forces in some of these cities will cooperate. But the mayors of some of these cities like Los Angeles and San Francisco have said, forget it. We're not going to help.
They are completely opposed to this. And what fascinates me is the public relations around this. If your real goal is to deport as many undocumented immigrants as possible, why announce it in advance? Why give everybody a heads up that this is about to happen, allowing those who are in danger of being deported to, say, seek sanctuary in a church or hide in some other way? This strikes me as what's really going on, that Donald Trump wants his supporters to know that he wants to get these people out, whether he succeeds or not. I mean, he'll get some people out. They say they're targeting 2,000 families, which in the grand scheme of thing isn't a lot. We have at least 11 million undocumented immigrants in this country. So targeting 2,000 families is already a relatively small slice. But as he did last time, when he announced it and then pulled back, so he creates a crisis and then solves the crisis within a matter of moments. Who knows what'll happen this time, but I think you have to look at the public relations around this almost before anything else.
So 2,000 out of 11 million, clearly it's just a symbolic gesture, it would seem.
Exactly right, Paul. But Linda is also right. Most of what the president does these days in terms of domestic policy is to stroke his base. I believe the President Trump's base is almost rock solid. Mm-hmm. For the most part, these are people who love him. They believe in him. They believe in anything. They believe anything he says, even if it's demonstrably false, and they will support whatever he wants. And I think that support is essentially unshaken. But the president and his advisors have said to friends and associates who sometimes talk to reporters that the president feels like there's no such thing as stroking his base too much, and that this is all designed to show strength and resolve and toughness. And that's really what it's all about more than anything else.
Now, I suppose one more question about this is his base, according to the polls, 40-45%. It's been inching up a little bit in the past couple of weeks. The question, though, is what kind of level of support among non-Trump supporters is there for this? I think surveys do show that most Americans agree that controlling our borders is a sovereign right and this kind of thing. So beyond the Trump base, how many people actually support what he's trying to do?
I think a lot depends on how you ask the question. If the question is about, should the United States limit immigration into this country? Should there be an orderly system for entering the United States legally and applying for citizenship? The vast majority of Americans should say yes. Do Americans support what's happening on the border right now with families being separated? The majority of Americans say no. So in terms of support for Trump, I think probably a majority of Americans don't like how he's handling this. But the overarching issue as we head into the re-election campaign is the economy. So you might have voters who are not part of Trump's rock-solid base, but who on balance see a strong economy and are willing to put up with his immigration policies and are therefore willing to vote for him.
So it's still the economy, of course, remains the number one issue. Well, moving on, kind of a related issue to this, the president also says that the government will not use the upcoming 2020 census to ask who is an American citizen and who is not. Now, for our global listeners, the federal government, every 10 years, collects data on people living here. They use this data for determining spending priorities and so forth. Tom, why did the president seek to add this question in the first place?
Well, there is a suspicion fueled by his opponents that what he wanted to do was to suppress Hispanic and Latino participation in the census on the theory that many illegal undocumented workers, whatever you want to call them, end up being Democrats, and that if you could suppress those individuals responding to the census, that might help Republicans. There is some evidence to suggest that that may have been exactly what the Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, was doing at the behest of the Justice Department and the White House, and that's what it was all about. The Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, said you can't do this. They basically said that the rationale presented by the president for why it was essential to have this question added to the census questionnaire was contrived, which is a polite way of saying this is baloney, this is ridiculous, they made it up. Well, the president immediately objected to the Supreme Court. Another example where he took the position, well, if somebody doesn't like what I'm doing, they're wrong. But he challenged the Supreme Court on this decision. And this was a way to try to get the information in another way. The Commerce Department was going to say, okay, the court has ruled, we're going to move forward without adding this question. But in 36 hours, President Trump started tweeting and basically said, not so fast. So he forced the government to try to find another way. And ultimately, another way really couldn't be found, but it was a strategic defeat. Well, let's see what happens.
Well, a strategic defeat, and yet if you listen to the president talk about it, he's quite skilled at kind of taking what appears to be a defeat and talking about it in a different way that makes it sound like it's not a defeat. And he said he's going to order all these other federal agencies to supply data that will give him the information that he wants anyway, without saying that these agencies have been doing that for a long time. Right. He's making it sound like it's something new that he just invented.
Exactly. No, it's another big public relations exercise. So the court rules and does, as Tom said, leave open a window to have a do-over to try to find another rationale that isn't, quote-unquote, contrived. They present hints that they're going to do that. Donald Trump tells us in the press corps, oh, there are 4 or 5 ways we could do this, but is never specific about what he means. And then lo and behold, when push comes to shove, he backs off, which is I think for a lot of us, a big relief, because if he had pressed forward with his attempt at a do-over, that would have put it all back into the court system. It would have caused perhaps an expedited Supreme Court hearing. As the clock is ticking, I mean, technically it's already too late. The Commerce Department had said these census questionnaires, the printing begins July 1. That's the hard deadline. You lost in the Supreme Court. We're going ahead. So by backing off, we've really dodged a constitutional crisis on this issue, where you have the potential for the Supreme Court to rule again against the president and the president to potentially defy the Supreme Court, which would be really serious.
We've avoided a constitutional crisis in that respect. But I think, Paul, this goes to the earlier point we were talking about. Even by losing, Trump not only has an opportunity to look like he actually didn't lose, but win or lose, depending on your politics, he has another opportunity to show he's tough. He's fighting the system. He's fighting the Supreme Court. He's fighting for his base against undocumented people who want to come in and take your job. So it's very calculated. And he knows what he's doing, and it remains to be seen whether it works or not.
And it's interesting to note, I think all three of us travel a fair amount. When you go sort of beyond Washington and you talk to, let's say, ordinary Americans, if I could use that phrase, to your point, if you talk to people who are rock-solid Trump supporters, they may not be familiar with some of the details about how the government has been supplying this data all along anyway. They think he's actually kind of moving the needle here, even when in reality he's not, but it's their perception that counts, as you've indicated.
Exactly right, and they don't care about a lot of what's happening in Washington. I was home in Texas, where I grew up. Not long ago, I had lunch with three of my closest friends from high school. We sat down, and the first words out of one of my high school classmates' mouth was, "We have to have security on our border." There is a difference between what's going on within the Washington Beltway and what's going on elsewhere.
Let's pause for a short break. More Issues in the News in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, go ahead and check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now, back to our panel, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. Our moderator is Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for USA Today and West Wing Reports.
Welcome back. Britain's ambassador to the United States has resigned after diplomatic cables were leaked revealing his thoughts about President Trump, and they were not exactly complimentary. Sir Kim Derrick is his name. Tom, give our listeners kind of the background here.
Well, he is the British ambassador to the United States. He's well known. He's smart. He's been in the British civil service for more than 30 years. And he has been highly regarded both in the United States and in the United Kingdom. Frankly, I thought he would have been replaced even before now. I guess his tour is up in very early 2020, but somebody in the British government leaked classified assessments of President Trump and the Trump administration, which every ambassador to Washington is obliged to do, report back to the home office about what's happening in Washington. And somebody with a malevolent intent, obviously, within the British diplomatic and political circles leak this stuff to embarrass him. Well, knowing that President Trump does not suffer criticism well, and Trump was very angry. And over the last several days, he said, "I barely know him. He has done a bad job for the United Kingdom. He's wacky. He's stupid. He's a pompous fool." Over the top, to put it mildly. I mean, many of us have been to functions at the British Embassy and have gotten to know this ambassador privately. And whatever else he is or isn't, whatever he thinks about who the next British Prime Minister should be, whatever he thinks about Brexit, he is not a pompous fool. He is not wacky, and he is not stupid. When the president went a little crazy. There was no way for him to stay, and so Darak had to go, and he resigned. And it has really put a schism, I think, in the relationship between the United Kingdom and the United States, two of the world's closest allies. I mean, I wouldn't say it's a rupture, but I would say it's really not a good development here.
The irony here, Linda, is that the way that the president responded to this, in a way, sort of confirmed what the ambassador said in these cables, which is interesting. But the broader issue here is that these diplomatic cables are supposed to be kept confidential. Mm-hmm. They allow an ambassador or other diplomats in mm-hmm. an embassy to share candid assessments about people and issues with their home governments. This appears to set perhaps a pretty dangerous precedent.
Right. And as I think Darak himself pointed out, everybody has been making this point. The content of Darak's cables is nothing surprising. It's what pretty much every ambassador is reporting back to the home country. So if Donald Trump wants to get upset about what ambassadors are saying about him, you also want to wonder who exactly leaked this. I mean, some people are wondering, is it even possibly a Russian hack? I don't know about that. I mean, we're in the middle of a transition in the British government. We're about to have a new prime minister, probably Boris Johnson, a friend of Donald Trump's. It's possible that Darak was going to be replaced anyway. So there's a lot in flux here. But I think even though it's a blow to the U.S.-UK special relationship, it isn't
not so special.
The end of the world. I mean, we're seeing these apocalyptic predictions that relations have reached a new low. But as Sir Kim himself said just last month in a piece, I think it was in The Atlantic, he wrote that the special relationship is built on more than personal ties. So it isn't just about how the current U.S. president feels about the current British government or the British ambassador. It's about this longstanding, very close relationship, as we saw in World War II, is that we'll survive this.
Things like shared values and
right, shared
heritage
language,
and
heritage,
and all
even
that.
Though the beginnings of the United States were obviously not a happy time for U.S.-British relations, but in everybody's living memory, it's a very close relationship.
And President Trump is not so big on alliances anyway, as everybody knows. He prefers to deal with the kind of a leader-on-leader thing and not deal with leader and leader dynamic and not deal with kind of a bureaucracy. So from that standpoint, ambassadors, in his view, are sort of irrelevant anyway.
Exactly right. But I mean, this is not just any ally. This is a very enduring and durable ally. And I would just suggest for a little homework lesson for any of our global listeners who are interested in this, you should pull out Henry Kissinger's first memoir and find a wonderful anecdote about a British ambassador at the time who was very critical of Nixon and how Nixon handled it. Basically, he decided that the relationship between the two countries was so important that he wrapped his arms around a guy, an incoming British ambassador, who didn't like him and who said things just as critical as the current British ambassador to the U.S. And it's an interesting read. I would recommend finding that one page in the Kissinger memoir to see how others may have handled this.
Well, people can always be candid after they leave jobs, and one person who was candid about this was the former French ambassador who just left his job a couple of months ago, I think Gerard Frog. And his quote is, well, this is what happens when a populist leader takes command in a liberal democracy. These people don't recognize or accept the idea that an ambassador or a bureaucrat could be of any use. They only want to deal with other leaders.
He also went on to say this could have happened to any of us.
To anybody. Well, moving on here, new tensions in the Persian Gulf. Iran is demanding that Britain release an oil tanker that British Royal Marines seized on suspicion that it was breaking European sanctions by taking oil to Syria. It's the latest bit of tension in the region, but we've never heard of kind of Britain and Iran. They've had tussles in the past, but this is kind of new for the two of them right now to be tangling.
Exactly right. I think Iran is, I wouldn't call them erratic exactly, but they are a little frantic and I think becoming increasingly desperate over the fact that the Western sanctions have really taken hold and are continuing to cripple their economy. And I think the Iranians are hoping that, while they think that they're not going to get any relief from President Trump, quite the opposite, that the Iranians are hoping that they can persuade the British and French and others in the Western alliance to ease off a little bit on the sanctions, and that there are consequences for the West, including the British, if they don't. And I think this was a little saber rattling that probably did not have the desired effect for the Iranians, because this British tanker was accompanied by a British frigate, which trained its guns on the Iranian patrol boats, and so they backed off. I think this is just more of Iran desperately trying to find some formula to get some relief from somebody, since they're not going to get any relief from the United States.
Now, Linda, it seems to me there are kind of conflicting dynamics at play here. The P5+1 nuclear agreement, the U.S., Britain, France, Germany, Russia, China, the agreement with Iran set these limits on how much uranium could be and to what degree it could be refined and all of that. And the Iranians have now said that they're going to break those limits and start enriching more highly enriched uranium, a violation of that agreement. Why are they doing that? Are they trying to drive a wedge between the other five countries and the United States here?
Right. They are trying to drive a wedge. And you also have to remember that this showdown came less than a month after the downing of an American surveillance drone by the Iranian military. So they're feeling, that almost led to a U.S. retaliatory military strike, or at least they say they were thinking of doing that. This is the Iranians flexing their muscles. I mean, this is nothing new. They've engaged in this kind of activity for decades. The Iranians know that they have leverage and they're trying to use it.
Now, the kind of a ancillary to this is that the tight relationship between Russia and Iran. What's sort of the Russian involvement in all of this?
The Russians are trying to tweak the American nose, even though Putin and President Trump profess undying friendship. The Russians are trying their best to project power all around the world, just like the Chinese are. And the Russians know that by backing the Iranians, that's going to be a problem for Trump. And the Russians always want to expand their sphere of influence wherever they are, in Syria, in the Middle East, generically. And so this is more mischief-making by the Russians, and I don't think they're going to back off.
The president has said to the Iranians, not directly, Linda, that why don't we talk? Just give me a call. How likely, in your view, is that to even happen?
I don't think anytime soon, but Trump is big on just talking to people. I mean, he could surprise us and decide at some moment that it's worth it for him to have that conversation. I mean, he likes to bust conventions and just talk to world leaders who seem to be our enemy.
It's interesting that, people thought that it was bad. Well, it depends on what side you're on. Republicans, of course, thought that it was bad when President Obama went to Cuba, but it was great when President Trump set foot in North Korea. He likes to break convention, Tom, and to Linda's point, maybe he could wind up talking to the Iranians, as implausible as it might seem.
Well, he loves being the center of attention always. He loves to be the ringmaster in the center ring of the three-ring circus. And it's diplomacy by spectacle. He loves spectacle. He loves staging a 4th of July event in the nation's capital last week with airplanes and flyovers of the Lincoln Memorial. And he likes the stagecraft and this diplomacy. He loves the spectacle part of diplomacy, and so I wouldn't be totally shocked. Right. I think a meeting with the Iranians would probably be, even for President Trump, a bit too much.
What would it take for them to do that? I mean, they've said, well, we're not interested in talking, and yet they're engaging in this provocative behavior.
I think they'd have to. The Iranians would have to say, you have to give me something more than a photo opportunity. You have to give us a small bone on sanctions. And I don't think the president is at all interested in doing that.
All right.
Because that would look weak.
All right. We'll have to end it right there. Thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Linda Feldman, she's with the Christian Science Monitor, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal. This program was produced by Kim Lewis, our engineer, Justin Thwaites. And I'm Paul Brandis. Thank you for joining us.
From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program are Jessica von Zastro and Ashley Obelgen, a